You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
We might be headed to the promised land
of speaking the truth
and finding
our external liberty once we internally liberate ourselves.
But their children were saved, and their children's children. Generations were saved by one decision, one person. But changing the world can happen anywhere, and anyone can do it. So what starts here can indeed change the world. But the question is, what will the world look like after you change it?
Welcome to Public Access America.
Make a stand. I know I did. Thank you very much, and may God bless America. May God bless America. May God bless
America. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Public Access America. I think we have our guest here, and I'm excited about that. Our friend Dan is going to be here to talk about a couple COVID scenarios and situations that have happened since the last time he was here. Hi, Dan.
Hello, hello. It's been way too long, guys. How are you?
Hey. Well,
you don't always get Superman on your schedule. You know what I mean? Sometimes you got to wait for him to fly in.
Oh, you're too kind. You're too kind. No, I'm very happy to celebrate a milestone and be part of the podcast. It's been great to kind of check in intermittently and see how you guys are doing and continue to support the channel. So
I appreciate you. You know, I was thinking about our time when we were podcasting and those things that we were trying to address with the Center for Election Science and for vaccines and with Lexi on women's rights, all of those things that we were battling in 2018 have evolved into a new level of confusion.
They've mutated, you can say.
Right.
Oh, that pun hit close to home there, Jeff.
Oh man, it's been a wild journey, dude. You know, you think about where we were just a few months ago, the lifting of mask mandates. We would finally turn the corner. Life was going to be normal, and then this shit happened. I don't even know. It's one of those things where it's been really frustrating, but at the same time, it's like, well, you know, I suppose that in terms of what diseases look like, this should have been expected.
Yeah, I think there's two very closely ingrained concepts here. One is, you know, you said what we should have expected versus what we should have planned and communicated, and those can be very different things, or they were kind of very different things. If you talk to any evolutionary biologist or microbiologist or genomic scientist worth their salt, it was obvious that as soon as we realized we could not contain COVID, that it's going to just continue to circulate, that, you know, this virus is going to evolve. It was going to mutate just like any other infectious disease does, just like any other organism does. And so having to be ready for that. But I think it kind of goes back to the challenge of we did not, in my opinion, as a society, do a good enough job with science communication early on, kind of setting realistic standards and saying, you know what, is the end goal here? People kept talking about like the pandemic ending, but they left it open-ended. Like, what does that mean? And for me, with my background in like microbiology, infectious disease, like this is the stuff I do, right? Like this is right my wheelhouse. For me, the pandemic ending was not the eradication of the virus. That's pretty much impossible. It was always, you know, we need to come to a point where we can manage the severe illness toll, the death toll, well enough. And I think that was not well communicated, because the way we think about disasters in this country is like, think like Hurricane Katrina, Superstorm Sandy, those things where there's a catastrophic moment and then there's months of fallout. And then, I mean, the deaths stop, the severe issues stop, the money kind of gets taken care of, and we as a society move on. But with a disease like COVID, that's just not how it works. And I think we could have done a better job at the beginning talking more about how that manifests itself differently than what we're used to as a society. And it comes back to the thing, like, really, we scientists have been kind of poo-pooing the concept of talking to the public for way too long, to the point where we have, like, ignored learning how to do that and have been focusing more on publishing papers and trying to get grant money than we have been about engaging the public and trying to get on the same level. Not that the public is lower, but it's like the public has different priorities and different things to worry about. So we need to kind of be more relatable. So I think this goes back to that same fundamental failure of, like, this was expected, but we didn't communicate it well enough, and we didn't use the right language to tell the truth in the right way that gets the public to understand and maintain that trust with the people who are working night and day to fight this virus. So, rant complete.
And that's, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, I've been trying to tell people is that the expectation is going to be that, you know, our bodies are not used to this particular virus, kind of like we are with the flu virus. You know, you've either not had enough variations go through your body, or you've not been vaccinated, or you've not been vaccinated with four different variations as it stands. And so, like, our bodies are just not used to this, which is why you're seeing people who got the original strain also get Delta, and you're still having issues. Like, eventually your body's going to learn. It's like, okay, we've seen something very similar to this. We've seen it multiple times. This is how we're going to fight this. And that's just kind of the reality where we're at. And so I'm kind of curious, what did that look like in the era of the Spanish flu? Like, you know, when you saw those waves come through, you know, granted, our testing and scientific capabilities are far better than they were 100 years ago. But maybe historically speaking, we can kind of see something like, you know, we saw the original Spanish flu, then we saw a variant, then we saw a variant, then we saw a variant. And eventually people had enough variants go through their communities that, you know, now, yeah, we get used to the flu going around. I mean, it still takes 115,000 people a year on average, but it's not the thing that it once was.
Yeah, I think you really hit it on the head there with the scientific capabilities being so different, like, 100 years ago. Back 100 years ago, I need to check my history. Did we even know that viruses existed back then? Like, we knew that influenza was a disease. We knew kind of it was spread by airborne and everything, but we had no concept of how beautifully, I mean, I guess beautiful for me, but how complex and diverse and funky the microbial world is. I mean, the germ theory of disease had just barely been worked on, you know, the previous couple of decades. And you think of how far we've come. I mean, one of the things that I keep reflecting on with COVID as compared to previous pandemics, including the 1918 flu, is we have so much scientific, I don't want to say perspective, but so many scientific eyes on this, right? You talk about naming all these variants, right? But it's not just that the variants are named. That's a very standard thing with the flu. There's a very standard international method for naming different types of flus that are isolated from different locations and different time periods from different sources. They're the types of surface proteins and everything. Like, there's all the standard stuff, and every kind of virus has its own standard format. But now, for the first time in modern history, all of that science has been thrust into the public eye, and everyone is scrutinizing it. And so scientists are struggling to catch up again with the communication piece of, like, okay, what is Delta? Is it a different virus? What is a variant? Okay, let's talk about what a variant is. Well, now we need to go back to high school biology. We're learning about DNA to RNA to proteins, which is stuff that people haven't cared about, because most people don't need to worry about what proteins their bodies are producing. They're trying to put food on the table. So I think I will answer your question directly, but I think that's something important to keep in mind, is that it does come up with a science communication again. But in terms of previous, in terms of any pandemic, it's a complicated balance between, you know, the term in the field is host pathogen interaction. So the pathogen being the agent that causes the disease, the host being the human or the whatever animal that it infects. So as the host develops immunity, the pathogen has to mutate. And those mutations are going to have, you know, better or worse outcomes, right? Just, and some are going to be selected for by natural selection. And some viruses are going to do really well. And so eventually there just became a balance between host immunity and the virus that caused the pandemic of 1918, that virus is no longer really viable. So other flu viruses could survive more easily than they were able to take over. And that's another complicated, like you talk about all these balances, you know, you have to think about what the end goal of a virus is, or end goal of a pathogen that causes any kind of disease is. The perfect pathogen is not a virus or a bacteria or whatever that kills its host really well. Because if you kill your host quickly or too seriously or cause too much severe disease, that host is going to be either isolated or die too quickly, and the virus cannot pass on. So eventually the 1918 flu had this perfect balance of like being what's called transmissible while also causing the disease that killed a lot of people. But eventually, because of the balance in host-pathogen interactions changing, that there was another virus that became more transmissible and just less deadly. So, but we still have isolates of the 1918 flu virus that people work on and put through cells and reproduce and study. And we still have those vials of virus to study, especially in flu labs around the world. And I actually was able to work on some of them in a past life in a virus lab. But yeah, no, I think you've raised a really good point about there is always this balance between host-pathogen interactions. It doesn't matter if it's flu, if it's COVID, if it's, you know, yellow fever virus or Zika or whatever. There's always these balances going on. But in order to kind of get the public to appreciate that, we can't just not communicate it and then just fling it all at the public and say, okay, here's all the stuff you should care about. And they're like, well, why? I was told I had to be furloughed from my job for 3 months because of some virus that I don't understand. Right. And that experience is valid. You can't invalidate that experience as a scientist and expect people to want to continue to trust you on month 20 of a pandemic.
Right.
I think you bring up a good point between the two. And when I think back in history, how information was disseminated, it was usually through a doctor or a professional. And I think we've diverted information around those people to bring it right to the public. And in that, I think the media offers pieces of the story. And I think people hear pieces of the story and they think they know everything when they used to be able to go to their doctor to get reliable translations of that information.
Yeah, and you still definitely can with a physician, right? But first of all, medicine has gotten so incredibly complicated that no physician's going to know everything. I don't pretend to know everything. I know the smallest fraction of the world of microbiology, and I'm a professional microbiologist, right? But the other thing is that going back, okay, I love this kind of theme of science communication, and I apologize for once again harping on it on another episode.
Do it. I love it. That's why we bring you on.
The main challenge, or a major challenge that we're facing, is that the people who are really good at the science and can really understand what's going on, and the people who are experienced at talking to the public and have created the platforms through which the public gains information, there's almost no overlap, right? Just in the mainstream media, obviously, you have people giving the news because they've been trained how to, their job is to deliver the news that other people deliver, and people can kind of translate and make it simplified. Here's a story that the public needs to know. But also in the modern side of like blogging and podcasting and the wide world of the internet, like what we're doing right now, right? There's not enough people who know the science well enough, can also understand the methods of the communication media that is used in today's, you know, society, and be able to leverage that to communicate that properly. Like, even scientists who've been really trying to catch up in the last year, we're still missing the mark. And that the reality is we're 10, 15, 20 years too late to the game. And we really just have to hope that we're prepared for the next pandemic, and that this has kind of awoken enough scientists' minds that like, hey, it's not enough to know the science. We have to know how to talk to the public. We have to know how to relate to the media. We have to know how to write for all audiences, and not a way that is condescending. And that comes down to a fundamental respect by scientists of saying, you know what, just knowing the knowledge of science is not the pinnacle of society. All right, that there's a philosophical break that has to happen at the highest echelons of the scientific community. And that's just either going to take time or another really serious issue to arise. But it is frustrating from my perspective as someone who did spend some time working in public relations and did spend some time working in, you know, podcasting and social media outreach and everything, and also knows the science, for a lot of scientists to go, even after 20 months, oh, this is, why the hell are you doing that? Like, the reason I'm doing that is because I care about wanting people to have good, accurate information. But I also care about the fact that science itself needs to evolve as fast as, if not more quickly than, this virus is mutating, if we're going to continue getting the public's trust so we can actually solve these issues.
Mm-hmm. That's a great way to put it. There is people out there that know what we don't know and take advantage of that, and you're the only people that can help that.
Yeah, exactly. So in terms of what the end of the pandemic looks like, is it when we can finally have enough cases without overwhelming our hospital system? Is it, you know, when we've had a certain number of variants? I think, you know, we have a lot of political pundits that will scream at the top of their lungs, Jim Jordan, about all of what the end of this actually looks like. And I don't think that, you know, one of the things that, you know, what the public is hoping for versus, I think, what science expects versus what public health expects. I feel like that's one thing where we've never really had this clear expectation. And maybe the answer is that there's not a clear expectation as of yet. You know, one of the things that I know that we've looked at is, you know, what does the end of the pandemic look like here in Washington State? And the answer has been overwhelmingly that, you know, it'll be when we finally stop having our system completely overwhelmed by one disease.
There's never going to be an end. It's going to be a gray line, not a black line. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. Now, you're absolutely, both of you are absolutely right. And that comes back to the analogy I raised before, like comparing this to like any of the hurricanes or, you know, 9/11 or the Afghanistan, you know, pullout that was, you know, all these things that the public sees as disasters or horrible things going on. There is a punctuated end when it comes to human events. Mm-hmm. And even though there's like consequences that build up on one another, like, you know, think about, I don't know, I'm just pick one out of the hat, you know, Benghazi, people were riled up about that. But eventually the actions that drive people's frustrations about that end in some way. And even right. though life goes on and there's consequences, like the past shapes the future, there is kind of an end to the storybook. And the reality is, when it comes to viruses, there is no end. There's one virus in the history of humanity that we've eradicated, and that's smallpox. And we're very close to eradicating polio. But the main thing is that smallpox and polio only used humans as a host. So when you talk about this scientific concept called spillover, by the way, Spillover by David Quammen, fantastic book. Even though it was published pre-COVID, it explains all this in beautiful detail. Would highly recommend to anyone who's listening. It really, really outlines this. But anyway, spillover is, you know, movement of an infectious disease from different animals into humans or vice versa, right? COVID has spilled over into everything. We've had a tiger test positive. White-tailed deer populations in the United States are testing positive for COVID. Obviously, the standard consensus is that this came from bats, potentially moved through other animals as well. There's close variants of coronaviruses. When you have a virus like that, it never goes away. It doesn't end. It doesn't go extinct. It just moves into another host and bides its time and changes over time into something else, right? So the reality is COVID's never going to go away. SARS-CoV-2 is never going to go away unless we eradicate all hosts from the planet in which it could possibly be. And if we vaccinate, it's impossible. We can't possibly vaccinate everything with 100% effectiveness. So it goes back. So what is the end of the pandemic? Like you said, Jeffrey, there's no consensus. What public health professionals want as an end of the pandemic versus what scientists want versus what politicians want versus what the public wants. The public wants to go back to normal. The public health professionals want, you know, to have to stop reporting this disease in large enough numbers that it overwhelms their days. And believe me, I have a lot of friends who are just overwhelmed, just filing reports of all these cases. And politicians want to move on to other stuff, and medical professionals want their hospitals to not be filled anymore. But that doesn't mean that the virus is gone. So having definitions and having missions that have clear, manageable goals, like specific, manageable, reasonable, like that's what we're missing. That's what we always missed, because we dove in, classic America, we dove in without a clear end goal in sight and just like, oh, we got to manage the situation. and having no
project. Right.
Granted, it's almost impossible. It was unprecedented for a new virus to emerge out of nowhere that we had no idea what was going on with it. But you still have to kind of at least try to envision an end at the beginning to help you guide your process. And I'm saying all of this as somebody who's practiced in COVID public health for the last year and a half or so. I was part of that system that was involved. And in some ways, this is a self-critique too, because these are things that I could have thought about better and could have potentially done a little bit to change, at least at the local level I was working at. So, you know, I don't want the listeners to think, you know, I am pretending to be holier than thou. This is as much a self-reflection as it is on other folks who are involved too.
It's always a learning curve, right?
Absolutely.
I can't help but think, though, that we didn't have 80 million Americans denying Katrina, you know?
Well, we certainly had more than 80 million Americans criticizing the response to Katrina.
Sure, right? but Katrina existed.
Exactly. Katrina existed, but the political political leaders involved in the Katrina response got heavily criticized. And a lot of people had a lot of their own ideas about how things could be done better. And so when it comes home and say, okay, well, if you all wear your masks and get vaccinated, you will not get COVID. Well, if that is speaking personally, from your own personal experience, if that does not line up with what you're seeing, like if you don't know people who are getting COVID, you don't know people who are dying, you don't know any families who've lost loved ones, then it's hard to relate that to your own personal experience. Whereas with anything involving people, like you think about the most, you know, some of the biggest reasons why, I mean, 9/11 hit so close to home because it literally hit home, right? Mm-hmm. Katrina hit home, Sandy hit home, Benghazi hit our soldiers, Afghanistan hit our Marines, right? So it's much easier for people to get a grasp of what does it mean for someone whom I love or care about to be killed instantly, or for them to be severely injured, or for us to be attacked on a day, than it is to think about the long-term evolution of viruses and gradual exponential growth and transmission around the world that maybe shaves off some part of the population that I might or might not know, right? So much gray area, but you still have the politicians coming up and trying to make decisions and still have people wanting to criticize the politicians for whatever reasons, good, bad, neutral, uneducated, educated. So you can draw parallels, and it is important to kind of keep that in mind, that the human experience lives on. It's just that the human nature has not changed. It's just that the circumstances of this disaster are drawn out and so different than what we're used to internalizing on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like the frog boiling. We don't notice it. And we need to realize that this is an actual virus planet. I mean, there's more of them than there is of humans.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's like insects rule the world. Viruses rule the world. Man doesn't.
Oh, absolutely.
We just need to learn how to live in
There's an estimate. So just to give the viewers an idea of this. So there's one class of viruses that are believed to be the most abundant are called bacteriophages, right? Literally bacteria eaters. They're viruses that only infect bacteria. They look like the little, you've probably seen them. Whenever you think of a virus, you think of a little like microscopic robot, right? That's a bacteriophage, right? That's kind of the classic look to it, right? The estimate is that there's about 10 to the 31 power bacteriophages in the planet, which is 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 all the way to 31. So take 10, add 31 zeros. That's the number of one family of viruses on this planet that infects bacteria. That does not account for the viruses that infect humans, cows, fish, birds, frogs, right? It's the microbial world is teeming with things that we can't even possibly scratch the surface of how complicated it is. And to think that we are in control of it is dangerous.
It's hilarious.
It's not just hilarious, it's hilarious. Dangerous. Because now with it kind of intersecting it with other issues, climate change, right? As the planet heats up, one major challenge has actually happened. There's Bissell's anthracis, which is the causative agent of anthrax. There have been variants of that have melted out of permafrost in the upper Yukon in Canada and in the boreal forests of Russia. Different strains of Clostridium perfringens have killed hundreds of thousands of deer in the steppes of Central Asia that have been, you know, emerged. You know, as the climate warms, the vectors of disease, the mosquitoes that carry Zika and West Nile are moving further north, right? infectious disease is you can't put it in a box. It's part of ecology. You have to understand that the global environment, and it's really kind of scary when you think about it. And it is boiling a frog in many ways. You're boiling 10 to the 31 times 10 to the 15 frogs at once and hoping that everything is going to be fine for the rest of humanity. Like, no, that's not right. But it's not right to say, oh, someone's insane for thinking that, because we don't think about that. We don't talk to the public about that. We don't engage people with that kind of knowledge nearly often enough. But we're very quick to deride people for not being on board with when we say that you guys should just listen to us because we know more. And they're like, prove it, which is a very fair response.
You do prove it, Dan.
Well, and that's the thing, like like we kind of talked about earlier. It's like questioning the science, you know, questioning in science is important, but the idea of questioning science means that you have the ability and the capability and the skills to be able to question specifics. Me being a numbers person, I can question numbers because I know how to analyze them. I know how to look at where information's coming from and make determinations on whether or not samples are biased or whether or not calculations were done correctly, whether or not the methodology makes sense. That doesn't mean that I have any ability to question, you know, like how your understanding of a virus. I just only know how to question the numbers. And so like this idea of questioning the science is great. Absolutely, we got to question the science nonstop, but we still have to have the abilities and the skills and education and reasoning power to be able to question specifics of it, not just say, well, I don't like that, so I'm going to call it questioning and not follow it.
Yeah, and I think the criticism in those, when you're talking about criticizing people who might, you know, disagree or question things without due process or without the right notebook with the right background and the right experience, I think it's really easy to do a lot of lazy dismissal. Like, oh, these people don't know what the hell they're talking about. Just whatever. We're not going to bother talking to them, right? You have to articulate the sources of these issues, and it's really complicated. In some cases, it could be a hyper-fundamentalist church that teaches that the COVID vaccine is the mark of the devil, right? Are all those people stupid and worthless and not worth talking to? No, they're human beings who deserve, you know, good health just like the rest of us. But you have to articulate the problem, which might be, you know, the minister in charge or the culture behind that or things like that, right? You have to criticize that very articulately. If you have a concern about the political communication about the vaccines, which I'm sure anyone can point out a criticism, right? Because everyone's screwed it up somehow, right? It's very easy to say, oh, the Democrats are just Trump was stupid, or the Republicans have no idea what they're talking about, or Newsmax did it. I know you guys can't see me, but I'm like waving my hands as I talk about that. If you can just like dismiss this, like Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake. It's easy to do. It's hard to engage in that nuanced criticism that you're talking about. Like you're gonna, I feel qualified to criticize the numbers or critique the numbers or have questions about the numbers because I feel qualified about that. That is a lot harder than just saying, oh, those guys are stupid. Now I'm gonna have a beer.
Right.
And move on with
it's
my
amazing
life.
How many people have talked to me about something until they finally said something where it registers to me. And they didn't give up on me. They just said it in a number of different ways until it could relate to me. So, and you're one of those people, Dan. I appreciate it. On a subject similar to that. So YouTube has gone ahead and begun taking misinformation off of its site, which is fascinating. And we were flagged for COVID information. We were reviewed, and they actually added a note to say not only are we not misinformers, but we are actually an authority on it. And that's because of YouTube. And I really appreciate that, because the moments we have talked about COVID, we have talked from a center perspective, not left, not right, just people, science, and numbers. And I appreciate you both for being here for that.
That's amazing. That made my month, man. I know it's only the third, but yeah. Still.
No, it is really cool. And I think there needs to be more of us than there is of them. And I think we got some numbers where we have a chance of winning. But do you think there's a chance of winning this war of misinformation on COVID specifically?
We Americans love to talk about war and declare war on stuff as if it solves the problem.
War on drugs.
Exactly. War on drugs. There's no war on homelessness, as George Carlin said.
War on abortion. Yeah. No, I just brought that up. Why don't we hyper-focus on 550,000 homeless people until it's gone.
Exactly, well, right? Well, I
mean, if it's anything like the war on drugs, we're just going to end up with more drugs.
Right. Exactly. Right,
yeah,
right.
I'm sure there's a lot of political commentary down that rabbit hole, but I just think it's interesting. We always talk about the war on misinformation. So there's wonderful classics, and it goes back to, you know, what I've learned in my training in infectious disease. There's these wonderful classic, you know, 18th century newspaper cartoons of when the original cowpox vaccine came out for smallpox, you know, where Edward Jenner used cowpox, which is closely related. You give people cowpox, a vaccine, and then that gives cross protection, right? And when people were talking about the vaccine, there's these amazing cartoons of like people transforming into cows because they had cow injections brought in. It's like, so as long as there's been public health, as long as there's been vaccines, there's always been misinformation. Think about smoking. Think about alcohol. I mean, back when they were trying to mandate seatbelts in cars, there was misinformation about people like choking to death, right? You know, it's human nature to, and again, I'm not a psychologist, but you know, if anyone has any proof that I'm thinking otherwise, please correct me. But it's human nature to want to criticize and want to be right. And so at some point it's easy just to slip into something that feels easy to understand. It's like, oh, well, the vaccine is gene therapy and the government hates me because I don't like paying taxes, right? Having that kind of logical fallacy going through, right? So it's easy to flip in, but as long as there's been public health, as long as there's been disease, there's been misinformation about disease, and there's people who want to profit from it, right? Like Joseph Merkula, right? Oh God, I hope he doesn't sue me for saying this. Multi-million-dollar businessman and pseudoscientist whack job who's made lots of money peddling anti-vaccine lies, and he has a pay-per-click blog that a lot of people subscribe to, and he posts stuff that is verifiably false, but it sounds good, and he gets clicks and he gets money in his pocket. So there's the misinformation, which is people just wanting to understand something that is simple or trying to digest the complicated world around them, and then there's the profiteers and the frauds and the scammers that peddle that misinformation for their own personal gain. And it's important for us to talk about those two groups very differently, because if we're going to call this a war, I'd rather declare war on the profiteers and declare humanitarian rescue on those who are getting profiteered from, right? Mm-hmm. And there's two different missions there.
That makes sense.
So let me ask you something in regards to boosters, because that's in the news as misinformation, but I think it can be resolved pretty easily. Joe Biden came out and said we should get boosters. The CDC said maybe not. The FDA said maybe in certain circumstances. And I think people are basing it on a timeline, as instead of, like Jeffrey and I talked about, the arc of antibodies. So are antibodies waning? Is that what we're looking for? And is there a way to determine your level of antibodies?
Yeah, I'm not a professional immunologist. I have a good amount of immunology training, but I'll try to display this, right? Everyone talks about antibodies because it's kind of the thing that we talk about colloquially the most when it comes to immunology. Immunology is way, way, way more complicated than whether or not you just have antibodies, right? There's antibody-mediated responses by B cells. There's adaptive T cell responses. There's all kinds of complicated stuff that goes on. But immunology in general is a balance, especially when it comes, again, host-pathogen interactions, like what I talked about earlier. It's always a balance between what the virus is doing, what the human response immunity is built up to, right? So in some diseases, antibodies wane, some don't. Some you have a fantastic response to. Some you don't need a lot of antibodies to actually stimulate a strong enough response. And a lot of that is based on not just the people, but also on the virus itself, how quickly it mutates, how it infects the body, what kind of damage it does to your cells, how it can hijack the immune system, right? It's really complicated, for example, to have any kind of immune, like vaccine therapy for, or vaccine prevention for HIV, because HIV hijacks the immune system. So there's all kinds of complexity that happens there. So antibodies can wane over time, for sure. The virus can also mutate so that the antibody virus binding or antibody cell binding that needs to happen is not, it's like a lock and key mechanism, right? You kind of shake part of the lock or shave a part of the key. It doesn't quite work so well. So it can happen over time. I think a lot of the booster conversation in general has been morphed by political opinion, and I don't want to get on a huge, you know, soapbox about that, but I thought it was telling that there was some hesitation by the scientific consensus of, like, not that it was unsafe, but whether or not it was necessary. And then there was the political and politically appointed leadership saying, no, these are necessary because there's a goal. It comes down to messaging and goals, right? You know, Joe Biden and the director of CDC, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, they want not just people to be safe from COVID. They want people to feel empowered that they are doing everything they can do to fight. They also might want a political win for themselves, right? I'm not trying to say that in a negative way. This is just trying to understand the humanity of the situation. So if you're talking about having additional boosters, there's no evidence that it's harmful. There's no evidence that it, that at least for the vaccines that have been developed, there's no evidence that it will make you worse off. It's just a question of whether or not it's needed at this time because of that evolving balance of the host pathogen interactions. Do we have a sufficient antibody binding at a high enough concentration? Are those antibodies waning over time or are they not? Is the virus mutating fast enough so that we need to have these boosters to overwhelm or to compensate for the kind of the lack of a perfect lock and key mechanism? Because if you have more of antibodies, you can kind of better account for each antibody not being as perfectly tuned. So it's complicated because on the immunology side, it doesn't hurt. Is it necessary? Your mileage may vary. On the political side, I can understand the motivation, and I'm not hateful or spiteful against political leaders for making the decisions that they did, because inconclusive, they want to act. They have motivations for acting, but I don't think it's nefarious. I think it's there's nothing inherently wrong with wanting the public to feel empowered that they're doing something to fight the pandemic, right? The question is, you know, how are you are you misleading them, or are you making a decision based on evidence that's publicly available and saying, you know, we're on the fence, but we're going to do this anyway, and being open and transparent about that. So that's kind of my thoughts on not just antibodies waning, but the booster question in general.
Right. But it could be, a large part of that was individual body responses to of ever-changing virus. So there's two sliding scales right there, and you need to talk to your physicians maybe about that.
Yes, definitely. And that was a lot of the conversation, a lot of the messaging. So there's the two lines that you get on your push notifications on your phone from your favorite news source, and then there's the full releases of information. Full releases are all like, here's specific subgroups that were most likely do need a booster. And even in the discussion about boosters, there are definitely some populations that could benefit from it more, like people who are elderly, people who are immune compromised, right?
Frontline workers.
If you need a vaccine because you are immune compromised, I mean, if the evidence is not 100% clear of whether or not it will help you, but the evidence is clear that it won't harm you, I can understand people in that demographic, you know, being encouraged to go get another booster, because if it's not going to hurt you, it might help. It could help. But then the nuance of which subgroups are supposed to get it. And, you know, all of this gets lost behind the, you know, someone wants to take a swing at Joe Biden, or someone wants to have a two-line news push. Some news source wants to be the first person to publish, entity to publish something. And so they put out an incomplete story. Or the FDA, you know, tasked writer A instead of writer B for the press release, and they decided to phrase a particular thing differently, right? So all these nuances just get lost in this discussion, and I feel that's a societal issue, that we don't like nuances often as much as we should.
Well, then one of the things that, you know, I remember, you know, that I was reading about too was that, you know, when you look at the different vaccines, you know, the vaccines were developed different ways, and one of the things that for example, Moderna went for maximum antibody production, where Pfizer, when they created their dosing, they were looking to minimize side effects of the vaccine. And so one of the questions that has come up that I've seen is that, you know, Moderna's protection doesn't seem to wane over time the way that Pfizer's has. But at the same time, too, most of what they're seeing waning for Pfizer, most of those populations weren't of concern anyways. Most of those populations were going to be healthy. They still have antibodies within their systems. Like you said, it's just the issue of who's most at risk, the elderly, the frontline workers, the immunocompromised. And even like the frontline workers one seemed to have been more of a hot button issue, where there was this idea that health professionals didn't need to get it versus they did, and it seemed to get overridden. And I'm not sure if that was more of a political decision or a, hey, we're already at capacity, so the idea of losing any capacity because the efficacy, you know, the effectiveness has waned over time, we probably want to account for that in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, and I think the operative term there is or, right? Either or. A lot of the discussion about vaccines in general has kind of descended into like either this or that. Does the vaccine work or does it not? Is COVID gone? Is it not? Is this pandemic over or is it not? It's complicated. And so when the way Jeffrey, like the way you brought that up was really, I'm glad that you discussed it in the way that you did, which is there were some political components, or was it, you know, science-based? Was there some evidence that was needed? It's not clear, because all of those factors played a role, right? You can talk about the different types of the pros and cons of the different vaccines and what Pfizer and Moderna's end goals, you know, talk about end goals, what the end goals for them were, and what we want out of the pandemic as a whole. But when you try to descend this whole conversation into like, okay, should I or should I not get the vaccine? Should I or should I not wear a mask? Should I, like, the binary nature is, again, one of the major reasons why we're having such a difficult time relating to the public, because there's nothing binary about a virus, right? Does the virus infect or does it not? Well, it only infects certain types of cells, depending on whether type you have this subtype of receptor A, right? You lose people, right? And it's understandable, because it's so hard to condense these issues into something digestible, because it's impossible to give this issue the nuance it deserves in one sentence.
Absolutely. And especially when you're,
people aren't general. People aren't general. They're all individual, and things affect them differently. Sorry, Jeff.
Oh yeah, no. And especially when, you know, you're trying to help people understand what does affecting people look like. You know, normally when we think about a vast multitude of diseases, we have this preconceived notion that it's, you know, this subgroup of people, it's old people, it's immunocompromised people, it's people who are obese. But what we're finding with this virus is you've got perfectly healthy people that are passing away, while you've got people who are, you know, in all of these comorbidities that you would normally consider most likely to go. There are the ones there, you've got people there that are surviving terrible cases of the virus, but people who were completely healthy gone within a week. And, you know, that being able to explain that to people has, I think, been one of the more difficult things, in that the predictability of the virus seems to be a lot less predictable than what we've been used to. And being able to scientifically explain why it's affecting populations the way that it is, why we don't have necessarily the clearest picture on, you know, who's getting it, who's dying from it, why is it this group of people right now versus another group of people with the last variant. I think, you know, people are getting frustrated with the fact that they see the virus, they see it like the goalposts are moving, when it's, the virus has evolved. So yeah, in a way the goalposts have moved, but it's not necessarily because of political movement. It's because the virus itself actually changed, and now we're having to learn what the goalposts are for this particular variant.
You're absolutely right.
Isn't science constantly moving a goalpost, though? Shouldn't you want it to have more information the more we learn about it?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the goalpost, right? So in some cases you don't want the principles of science for the goalpost to move, right? You want scientists to act with integrity. You want them to have good research ethics. You want the peer-reviewed studies to be criticized fairly. You want people to be reporting data honestly, not defrauding, you know. Having all those things in place, it's important to have those things.
Right.
It's important to have those things. I'm sorry, I have a puppy just came onto my couch. go away. She's really cute.
Knowledge is an evolution, yeah. Though, is what I'm
Yeah,
trying
so
to
the,
say.
The Lear- principles of science it. Are important to keep in there, but the knowledge will move. Unfortunately, when it comes to folks who, Jeff, do you have just a puppy issue as well?
Yes, hi. I have a puppy issue. This is Billy.
Hi, Billy. Hello, handsome boy. But what happens is, for folks who aren't really steeped in the scientific culture, and it really is a culture more as just as a profession, when they see the goalposts moving, they also they think that maybe the scientists are just trying to account for you know, maybe they were kind of wrong before. Now they're trying to continue to be right. Right. Cause that's a very political, like politicians love to do that too. Like move those goalposts. And it comes down to the fact that, and Lisa, this is speaking personally, going back to that middle school, high school science class, science to most people who take a science class is a bunch of facts about the world that you need to memorize and regurgitate onto a test. Right. Static. Whereas it's static truth of facts. Right. Reality is that science is a process. It's the method and the protocols and the ideas and the things that the goalposts should stay true is the process. But we don't teach process, we teach product in school because it's easier to put into a standardized test. And so when you have millions and millions of people whose only kind of familiarity with science is that like memorization, there is an answer. And then you present them with an issue where people who are trying to speak the best truth that they can based on the best available evidence get things kind of right and then have to change their answers as more evidence becomes available. It's no wonder there's this incompatibility, right? And again, it comes down to how we're teaching science, how we're doing outreach, how we're engaging with the public to make sure that before something happens, the preventative measure of saying, you know, this is what needs to be, this is what science is in reality. Like behind every single answer we give you is a process and a debate and a discussion. And because all of this is being scrutinized so heavily in the public eye, you know, these are things, you know, host pathogen interactions for viruses, people spend their whole careers understanding one subtype of one interaction between virus A and one type of host, right?
And that's based on the subjects that you can examine, right? The more cases you have, the more knowledge you have. If you have one case of COVID, you assume that it's one way, it's killing in one way.
Exactly.
If you have 100, you can learn more.
Yeah. And that's as you get further out to the population level, you can start having more one sentence answers. And that's the importance of, you know, one of the aspects of science is like having good data collection, right? And why we listen to or pay attention more to the meta analyses of 3 million patients than we do about a single case report about a weird thing that happened with one person. But because the personal experience is more relatable to most people, that is what kind of jars you. Because when you talk about one person, what's, you know, I'm not trying to praise Stalin in any way, but what was the thing he says, like one single death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. Right. The metaphor for that being you can relate to that one person at the other end of the case report. You can't relate to the population of 3 million anonymous people who participated in a trial to answer a broad-facing question about whether or not there's generally more or generally less risk at a population level. That's hard for people to relate to, but that's what we have to do when making policy decisions that affect 350 million Americans.
Good point.
Yeah.
So we have this study from the UK that I actually wanted to get you to talk about more of the long symptoms of COVID, the long haulers. And they're saying that the people they're examining they're finding organ damage, at least one organ damage in everyone that they've examined. And how do you know that? How do you know it wasn't from before? How do you know that this is because of COVID? And what are some other things we should be looking out for? I want to scare people into getting the vaccine by letting them know that there's possibilities things could go wrong if they don't.
Scared? Oh man, I'm a nuanced boy, right?
It's October. It's Halloween. Let's scare them straight.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing is like if you give people fear and then they feel that it wasn't worth being afraid of, that just sows distrust.
Gotcha.
But generally talking about long COVID. Yeah, it is something that we're just barely able to understand, right? The chronic complications of COVID, just because we're in less than barely into 2 years since this virus likely, you know, started breaking into the population in Hubei province in China. 2 years. But again, these kinds of diseases, like I mentioned earlier, these are individual scientists' careers. Someone could spend 30 years studying, you know, one type of disease, whether infectious or like melanoma or some type of kidney disease. Like those are entire careers that people sink their teeth into and only make some progress on. So when it comes to long COVID, you know, there are these observational studies. There is kind of statistically significant enrichment of this organ damage in people who had COVID and then reported long-term symptoms of COVID. But then in order to understand that more, we need to study more, okay, how did this virus directly infect someone's kidney or liver? Or was there kind of systemic damage? Was there kind of an antibody cross-reactivity autoimmune response? You know, all these nuanced questions. And the science needs time to understand all of that. But right now, all we have right now are these cross-sectional observational studies. And by cross-sectional, I mean like point in time, right? There's, you know, you can have prospective studies where you like study a group of people in your who are participating over time. There's retrospective studies where you like have a group of data that you look back in time, and cross-sectional, which is like in there's someone in a point in time, you get information from them, right? And how those studies contribute to science also messes with the question. So if this is a cross-sectional study of like, hey, they have this organ damage and they have long COVID previously, that doesn't really explain that might start to show an association, but until you track people for a long period over time and really start to understand the symptoms that they get and the diseases and conditions they get over time as they evolve, that takes a long time and a lot of money and a lot of effort from a lot of people in order to get that valuable information. So in terms of scaring people, we shouldn't be scaring people. We should be informing them. Long COVID is a thing. Long COVID, we know we have sufficient information that COVID for some people is not just a week or 10 day cold and you move on with your life. It's not just something that you get asymptomatically and then pass on to somebody else and it's not really your problem anymore. There are long-term consequences to this, and also from acute disease as well as chronic disease. We're getting more information. It's more and more evidence that people should get vaccinated for a lot of reasons, mainly about protecting yourself from the virus. And I can get into more detail about that. There's a lot of really good evidence coming out to support vaccination, but we need more time to understand these processes as they evolve, quite literally, and get more evidence. And unfortunately for science, that takes years. We're just not used to having to answer to the public on such a broad scale so immediately about so many questions at once. And we're just not equipped to answer all those questions at once.
No, and absolutely correct. You know, and the fact of the matter is that even when we're able to finally form, you know, something that we can say to people, we're usually having to battle social media at that point. And, you know, the sound bites from pundits and politicians and news sources. And so, like, I think, like, kind of one of those things that you've gone back to is that our ability to message has just been, well, asked for the lack of a better term. We're just not able to get the same level of quick, easy messaging out to the population that, you know, we've seen spread through social media.
You're absolutely right. And that's something that, again, because that takes time to instill in people and the appreciation for that value, right? Social media has been around for a while, a hot minute, right? And people who recognize the most successful marketers are those, or the largest companies that have, you know, built themselves in social media, including the social media companies themselves, are those who recognize early, hey, this is what the potential can be, and let's have a 5 to 10 year plan to build this out, right? Science does not have a 5 to 10 year plan on how it's going to evolve its communication about COVID. Science does not have a 5 to 10 year plan about how we're going to train more science communicators who are not just well-versed in the science, but also well-versed in public outreach. Science does not have a 5 to 10 year plan on how we're going to get more people out of the lab and value the importance of getting more people into the public eye to answer those difficult, nuanced questions and to get people thinking about the process of science like we talked about before. When you don't have a long-term plan, you're not going to have a good solution. That's just the reality of no matter what discipline you're in, be it like military operations to business planning and entrepreneurship to just running a school, right? If you don't have a long-term plan and a mission and a goal, there's no end in sight, right? You don't have a clear definition. So I think that's something that science needs to learn from, is that we, as we publish these studies, we also, if not more so, need to be telling the public, there's going to be a lot of studies coming out, right? People are still studying and making careers off of studying the 2009 H1N1 pandemic flu, because all kinds of viral stocks for that exist. And it's a pretty standard, you know, basis for studying influenza now. Everyone and their dog who's in the field has a bunch of vials of that that they thaw out of their freezer and study by passaging in cells and seeing what happens, right? COVID is going to be a reality in science for the next forever. So we start messaging, COVID is going to be a reality in science for the next forever. And we're going to be having these long, this is a whole new field of science that's been created. And nobody's really telling people that. That's a really serious challenge that we have. It's like, this is going to continue. As COVID continues, we're going to continue studying it. And people are going to make a lot of impact over a long-term career because COVID's not going away. And as COVID's not going away, the hospitalizations and deaths are going to continue. Every year people die from the flu. Every year people die from other viruses. Something we need to be prepared for. And science needs to get on its horse to start talking about how and where and when it's going to intercede and where it's going to provide those updates, not just giving the updates themselves out of a blue and not giving people context and how to interpret the information.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I think that's one of the things that we're going to have to start telling people to is how do you make a game plan as a family, you know, in order to keep this up. I mean, I don't know that we necessarily had that level of this level of information or thought process and how do you deal with this in, like, for example, a public health, public school setting, like something that's a very real issue for all of us, where you've got, you know, school-aged children 5 to 11 who can't get the vaccine yet. But, you know, like here, for example, one of our schools is remote for the next 2 weeks because they have an outbreak.
Good.
So the question becomes, you know, what is it, what do families need to do in order to game plan for what this pandemic is going to continue to look like until we no longer call it a pandemic? And I think, you know, number one is going to be, you know, what does your vaccination plan and home health plan look like? What are things you can do at home to make sure that you still have a fighting chance until, like we've talked about, this thing, you know, gets to a form that's less lethal. And we're not constantly wondering if hospitals are going to have a bed for a person if they absolutely need it.
Yeah, I think it even more fun. All the questions, all the points that you raised are exceptionally on point and things we all need to be discussing. But I think there's a more fundamental point that needs to be digested by the public before we have any of those discussions. And that is the reality that this is not the first time this has happened. In terms of a major public health crisis, like the 1918 flu pandemic, all kinds of different things. The reality is that whenever something like this happens, we never go back to normal. There's always a new normal. There's a readjustment. There's what we're going to be facing moving forward is not going to be the same as what we had before, right? Thinking back to the history of the 1918 pandemic, after that kind of subsided, there was a massive injection of funding at the federal and state level to start caring about public health. And a lot of the public infrastructure that we have today is due to funding and investment that happened. The federal government took note. There was more legislation that was passed in terms of structure, very important Supreme Court rulings about the cans and cannot or do's and do nots of public health practice. All kinds of research became available, and that changed our society. After the Second World War, I mean, you know, after the discovery of penicillin and the Second World War, penicillin became very widely available because it was shipped over to the Allies in such large quantities because of all the infections that people were getting, soldiers were getting in combat, that it became, once the war effort stopped, we now had antibiotics that fundamentally changed the way that we treated all kinds of health, right? And going through these decades, the questions you're raising about how are we going to manage remote work? How are we going to manage, you know, people from home from school? How are we going to manage isolation and quarantine? Do we need to continue isolating and quarantine once we get a vaccine regimen in? Are we going to be concerned about the evolution of the virus? How's that's going to continue? All these things have to come. We have to ask those questions. We have to be willing to engage in those discussions. But there first has to be an acceptance that we're not going back to what early 2020 before looked like. This is going to be a new normal. We are in a new society. We have changed. If just as much as we did after 9/11, just as much as we did after World War II, just as much as we did after the 1918 pandemic, right? Society will continue to move forward. We need to accept that and then start asking those questions. And that's a really hard pill to swallow if, again, you're in some country town where you don't really know anyone who's gotten COVID and you don't want the world to change because life's kind of good for the way you see it. You know, it's hard to get that message through.
Absolutely. And realistically speaking, it's, you know, it's going to be one of those things where we're our messaging is going to have to adjust, like you've talked about, and we're just going to have to get used to, you know, the fear mongers on any side of the political spectrum being willing to ship us doom and gloom in any part and figuring out how do you minimize those voices. Realistically speaking, this thing's going to be a lot more manageable. In time, it will be a lot more manageable, you know,
but not gone,
never gone, you know, and the new normal, like Dan says, is going to be, you know, whatever your individual risk assessment looks like. You know, at some point it's going to be masks off. At some point it's going to be back to sitting down in a restaurant, eating around people. At some point it's going to be back to large family gatherings and concerts. And our, you know, our evaluation of the risks individually are going to change. Some people are going to be willing to, you know, take, well, they're not going to see it as a risk. And some people won't see it as a risk because they're vaccinated. Some people won't see it as a risk because whatever else. And the reality is going to be that everybody's risk calculation is going to be different. And we're just going to have to accept that. You're just going to have to learn how to minimize and mitigate for your own risks and what that looks like.
And then policymakers needing to be aware of how to look at the larger level and say, what is the balance of risk mitigation with public inconvenience? That's always been the fundamental question of public health policy and public health law, right? That balance between, I mean, public health policy is restrictions on public freedoms that are deemed necessary to prevent people from dying needlessly, right? That's just the baseline definition of it. That's always been the battle. We go back even, obviously, we, you know, go back to the 18th century with the United States, but way, way before, you know, the whole point of quarantine, like quarantine was initially, it was a Genoa or Milan or Venice, right? Ships from the Middle East and from the Near East were quarantined for 40 days, quarantine, right? Stay in place for 40 days off coast to let any diseases run their course, mainly smallpox, before the sailors were allowed to board the ships or to come off the ships and come to land. So public health policy has been in place as long as people have known that diseases are a thing. And it's always been a battle between what are people's rights and privileges to make the individual decisions that they want and the necessity of government to step in when the greater good needs to be protected. And because of everyone's individual beliefs, you know, politically, that's a different balance for everyone. It's going to have a different, you know, set of opinions on that. And so we need to have policymakers who understand that that is going to continue to battle and continue to prioritize public health, because I guarantee you, I mean, I've said this before, I'll say it again. I will bet my life savings that before I am gone from this planet, barring some serious traffic accident or something, that we will have a much, 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 much worse pandemic than we did from COVID. It's kind of like the U.S. Geological Survey not allowing its drivers, its members to drive on elevated highways in the Bay Area around San Francisco, because they know a major earthquake is going to hit. It's the same thing. We know another major pandemic is going to hit sometime in the future, sometime in living memory. So what lessons can we draw forward from this? A lot of that has to happen at the policy table. It's not just scientists siloed in labs, you know, in the disaster movies, giving people warnings that are ignored. Scientists need to break out of that and say, engage with policymakers, and policymakers need to be listening. So that's kind of the major message that we need to think of in this new normal, is this needs to be incorporated into our mainstream kind of structure as a society that we can prepare and kind of converse in on a regular basis.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I love that. Do you think that you say there's going to be another bigger pandemic, but do you think this one was as big just because of the response that we initially had? I mean, did it only get big because we ignored it?
It could have been so much worse. We could have had millions and millions of Americans dead if we didn't have the initial shutdown. Right. Okay. Think of it this way. We know that the vaccines work really well. We know that people are going back to normal. I mean, my life is starting to go back to, I don't want to say back to normal, right, like have a new normal where I'm careful with my friends. If I ever get the sniffles, I'm not going out for a while. I'm going to go get tested, right? All those new things. But speaking personally, I am making some of those decisions to spend time with friends whom I also know are vaccinated and being responsible. And as I evolve that out, right? But think, a lot, if we know the vaccines are there, we know that some people are making more responsible decisions now, but we're still kind of opening up. We're still seeing the surge in cases with Delta. Imagine what would have happened if we just didn't shut down. Right. Mm-hmm. Think of the death toll that we're facing now. All that stuff about flattening the curve. You know, what is it? Idaho and Alberta, Canada are now doing triage, like, yep, you know, scarcity treatment of their patients. Like, they're not like every patient coming in is a DNR. And like, again, I don't know all the details, so people fact check me on that. But those, that could have been completely, what was happening in New York City could have been the entire country at once if we did not shut down. Yep. Right. So, and the shutdown was absolutely devastating, right? Millions of people left, not just lost their jobs, but left the workforce. It caused a massive recession. The stock market went crashing down, right? We had these major systemic issues. Now, what are we as a society going to do knowing that there could be something that's 10 times worse with an actual mortality rate of like 10% as opposed to like the 0.5 to 0.9% that people estimate for COVID? How are we going to prepare for that? What kind of systems are we going to have in place to make sure that we can actually continue to function as a society and not be crippled for decades by something really severe? Because back in 1918, I'm in Pittsburgh, and there was some of the earliest Pittsburgh trolleys were converted into corpse carts, where people would just like leave their dead family members out on the sidewalks, and the corpse cart would come pick them up. Like, how do you, and now the way how complicated and integrated our society is, like, if that happened, if that was a reality, how would we survive as a society, right? We need to start asking those questions now, and that has to be people stepping up and saying, look, this was a dress rehearsal. The next big one is on the horizon. We thought this was the next big one. In some ways it was, in some ways it definitely wasn't, and we need to be prepared for that. So, I mean, I'm not trying to inspire fear, like I mentioned earlier, but maybe that's something that our listeners can consider is like, what kind of leaders do we want in our country who are going to acknowledge that fact and be prepared for it? What kind of leaders are going to want to start integrating public health discussions more into policymaking? How is that going to affect our economic policy, our social policy? Because we need to be prepared for that reality that's going to happen eventually. And we need to be, the first step is talking about it, but people need to be thinking about it and engaged with that, you know, heart, like that uncomfortable idea. I don't want to say an inconvenient truth, but it does come to mind, that phrase.
I got you. So claiming it's false isn't our way out of it. Planning ahead is.
Yeah, don't ostracize the situation. This is only going to get worse.
Right. I wanted to ask you about Merck created a new pill that hopefully disrupts COVID. Do you know anything about that? Because I really would like to finish up on therapeutics. If that's okay.
Absolutely, yeah. So there's a before we go into the details of this, I mean, because obviously this is integrated into the ongoing, you know, sentiments about hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and all these other drugs, right?
Oh, and nebulizing hydrogen peroxide.
And drinking bleach. Right.
Oh yeah.
Injecting bleach. Like, yeah. All that great stuff, right?
Oh my God.
Sorry.
Yeah, I know. But
there is therapeutics that work, and I think we should steer people to those if we
So can. We should. I think it's important before we go into that discussion to talk about the fundamental difference in philosophy between vaccines and therapeutics. Right. Vaccines are designed fundamentally to prime your immune system to be able to take care of a virus itself by itself. Once you have been exposed, right? And exposure means you are technically, some of your cells are infected, right? You're like, as soon as virus gets into your body, it could get in, right? Exposure, it's not like you go from exposure to, oh my God, you're sick. Like, there's a process of some cells in your body getting infected, right? But vaccines are designed to stimulate an immune response that suppresses the amount of virus that your body can make by being able to quickly respond, to detect and respond to an infection. A therapeutic, like the drug that Merck just popularized, I don't even remember the name. There's some standard naming system for viruses. So avir, like that suffix is like, you know, antiviral. Anything like mAb, something that the technical name ends with mAb is a monoclonal antibody, and then like HUMAB. HUMAB is a human monoclonal antibody. MUMAB is a mouse. ZUMAB is a different type of, you know, there's all kinds of standard definitions. So there's the vaccines that are designed to stop or to quickly recognize and nip in the bud an infection by your own immune system working for itself. And the therapeutics, your immune system can't handle it. You get really sick. You have a very high viral load. And then you add something to your body to try and help your immune system catch up.
right? Mm-hmm. And it's pretty obvious which one is preferable, right? The vaccines are always, having a good vaccine is always a better bet than mm-hmm. having a good therapeutic. Because first of all, if you have a vaccine, if you can keep that viral load low, then there's less of a chance of you, you know, pushing virus out into the environment and infecting other people. There's also less of a chance of you getting severely ill, and there's less of a chance of you needing additional medical care.
Right.
But when you have a therapeutic, you've already probably at the point where you've exposed somebody else, and you're already at the point where you probably need some kind of substantial intervention where you're really down for the count and need a lot of help. So something to keep in mind there. All that having been said, so this therapeutic is a nucleoside analog. And I need to look into more of it, but there's different ways that the antiviral drugs work. But all of them mess with your cells, because viruses, mm-hmm. the way that viruses reproduce is they infect your cells and they hijack them to be little factories for viruses, right? If they're not like bacteria, where some bacteria live inside your cells, different story, but most of them will grow out like in your body, but outside your cellular tissue and cause like a large mass of stuff that like causes a big problem, right? Viruses use your cells directly. And that's why you have very few antiviral drugs on the market to begin with, right? Antibiotics, we have a bunch of them, different conversation for another day, because you can actually design drugs to just kill the bacteria, because bacteria are fundamentally different from us in many ways. So you can design a drug that like kills the bacteria, but not ourselves. There's no way to design an antiviral drug that doesn't go into your cells, right? It has to go into your cells. It has to mess with the replication, the cellular machinery that you have, because that's what the virus is using. And so you have like this nucleoside or nucleotide analogs that are designed to literally stop or throw a monkey wrench into the engines that make your cells DNA and RNA, right? That's not a good thing. Like that, there's always side effects to that. There's also there's other variants that maybe stop binding or anything by blocking like receptors in your cells, but again, that's working on your cells, stopping them from working properly. So therapeutics are useful. They have a place. Obviously remdesivir has saved countless lives in hospital settings. Hydroxychloroquine obviously didn't pan out. Ivermectin, a huge debate. This one could be a useful addition to the arsenal for people who don't want to get a vaccine, or who do get vaccine and get very sick in that rare case. But it's something to keep in mind is that the therapeutic is essentially, it's useful, but in some ways it is a really potent poison for your own cells, where you, it's kind of like chemo in a way. Like chemo works by killing your own cells and the cancer, right?
Right.
But antiviral drugs work by messing with your cells to stop the virus. There's always collateral damage. With a vaccine, the level of collateral damage for a well-designed vaccine is always going to be lower than that of an antiviral drug. So something to keep in mind when you're like, if you're hesitant to get a vaccine, but you really want to get this new antiviral from Merck that goes inside your cells and messes with your cellular machinery, right?
Your DNA.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure about DNA in this case, but some DNA viruses, you have antivirals that will mess with your DNA replication machinery, right? So it can get messy. This one probably RNA. But still, mm-hmm. right? It gets messy in there. And so
these are short-term solutions too. These are not long-term. Mm-hmm. These are like you're down for the count. This is something that you're needing in order to address the situation now, and it's not something you're staying on, and it's not something that's going to give you long-lasting protection.
Absolutely. Right. It's not long-lasting protection, and by the time you've already gotten the therapeutic, you've probably exposed somebody else to the virus. And it's like the standard dose for this is like 800 milligrams of like a nucleoside inhibitor that messes with your machinery, as opposed to like, what is it, like 0.3 micrograms of mRNA in the vaccine dose.
Right.
Like the sheer volume. And they talk about like the same thing with like the Regeneron therapeutics that Ron DeSantis was peddling. It's like the other thing that Merck is applying these data for an emergency use authorization. The Regeneron therapeutics that are developed are different science, but still emergency use authorization, right? Why are you lapping up an EUA drug that is way more potent and potentially toxic to your body than you are to a vaccine, which is either FDA approved or has been authorized and out for months and months with lots of evidence showing that it's safe, that has a lower dose of whatever it's giving you, offers longer term protection, and prevents the problem from happening in the first place, right?
I'm glad you said that.
So
I'm really
so,
glad you said
so
it that.
So good,
way.
good on Merck for offering another tool in this fight. I applaud them. Well done. I hope it gets authorized as long as the data show up, hold up. But it's important to keep in mind that this is not a replacement for vaccines and that vaccines are the superior option. Always, it's what's the old adage? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Yep.
Perfect. And you said that the ivermectin, that's a big debate. That's not a big debate, right? Ivermectin isn't something that we want to use against COVID.
Yeah, so there's... don't use the freaking veterinary horse ivermectin, please. Like that's not
yes,
right.
Right.
Don't dip into your local farmer's stash of, you know, nematode killer. But there is some evidence out there. It's mixed about whether or not like human formation of ivermectin might or might not work. The jury's kind of out. And so my personal opinion on ivermectin is that like we should continue to study it in the human dosage. But again, it comes out to this messaging. If someone comes out, ivermectin is the new next great thing. You can go to Petco and get it for $3 a pound. And that's, it's just like, it's like, okay. And these same people were like yelling at the millennials for doing the Tide Pod challenge. Right.
Right.
So it comes down to like when used properly and studied properly, I don't think the evidence is as conclusively bad. I mean, there's the ivermectin project, which has some RCTs, randomized controlled trials that show that it could potentially be effective. But again, how does that come into practice? Well, if you're just going to have the veterinary, you know, formulation, which is not the same, is going to self-dose instead of going to a doctor, if the doctor is going to, you know, prescribe without understanding the mechanics of that drug, or if you're going to rely on that, even though it's not even authorized, not even approved, not even reviewed by the FDA, not even recommended by the FDA, as opposed to a vaccine that has gone through multiple rounds of retrospective reviews and peer-reviewed studies and all this stuff. Like the evidence for vaccination is so much, it's much more robust, a lot more, and hundreds of millions of people have gotten the vaccine. So we have kind of the test group that we're already studying and showing that it's effective. So again, good to have antiviral drugs, good to have that as part of our arsenal, but prevention is so much more valuable, and the vaccines are fundamentally a protective and preventative tool. So that's why I will always recommend the vaccines over just relying on it. Now, if you're sick and you need it, don't take this advice like, oh, don't get the drug, right? But always opt to get a vaccine over just hoping that the cure might work for you.
Yeah, I think people are working overtime to avoid a vaccine when you could just be done. Like, I got the vaccine, I don't worry as much. I still care about who's surrounding me, but in my daily life, I don't need to protect myself in a lockdown scenario like I did. The vaccine has helped me. And there's people that are actually working to avoid the vaccine, and they're hurting themselves to do it just to prove a point that they don't need the vaccine. Just get the vaccine.
Yeah, and there are, but there's also lots of people who are still worried about the vaccine because they've heard horror stories, or they're concerned about the whole process, and trying to, you know, make sure that when those people come to those of us who care with those kind of concerns, like, I don't want to get the vaccine because I've heard this really messy thing, and I wanted to come from that place of like vulnerability, learning, doubt, concern.
Yes.
Those are people that we should be engaging with and trying to get really reliable evidence and listening to their concerns and showing that we're valued. Again, talking about what I mentioned before about like having a war on misinformation, right? You can viciously attack the peddlers of false information.
Right.
Who profit, the people who promote it. But the people who listen to it and have their concerns, take a humanity first approach, right? You've got to treat these people with respect, because their concerns and their doubts are exceptionally valid. They deserve to be treated with respect. And that is how we're going to make progress in this pandemic, is treating people with that dignity that they inherently deserve.
Absolutely. And I find that the best way that I've been able to help people figure out what they need to do next, you know, I've got a friend who's been struggling because, you know, on one side they had a sister get Bell's palsy from getting the vaccine. That absolutely happened. I mean, everything has an inherent risk. But on the other side, also had a family member damn near died because she was unvaccinated, and they had to life flight her. eventually. And she's scared because, you know, on one side, you know, she's seen the reaction that a family member's had. And on the other side, she's seen someone almost die and talk about how it's the worst thing that they've ever experienced. And the reality is that Facebook is not a substitute for going and talking to your doctor about your concerns and getting actual information, doing tests to see if you actually are somebody who can get the vaccine. Medical exemptions need to be something that we really need to look into for people who really can't get the vaccine, because that's why we all got vaccinated to begin with before this whole COVID thing ever came around. We knew that there were people that were never going to be able to get the vaccine. And our, as part of our societal responsibility, was making sure that we created as few vectors as possible for those people who were compromised, so that way they didn't get sick. And that's still fundamentally the same thing as it is today. You know, the vaccines, are they perfect? Absolutely not. Not a single one of them has been. There are always going to be inherent risks. It's just that, what is your level of risk exception? Is it going to be ending up dead in a hospital? Or is it going to be, you know, potentially having a side effect from a vaccine? And the best way that you can get yourself into a place of being able to make a decision, talk to your doctor.
Well said. Well said. Yeah.
There's 7 billion people. There's one vaccine. So,
well, there's three vaccines. There's three vaccines.
The three, maybe four soon.
Hopefully.
The variables are in the humans, not really the vaccine as much. You know,
actually, I stand corrected. It's like 15 vaccines.
Is there already?
Yeah, I mean, holy cow. Yeah, we talk about Sinopharm and AstraZeneca and all the other ones and Russia's version. So, point well taken is that there is this amazing tool. There are these amazing tools out there. It's important for us to use those tools properly. And the first step of that is humanizing the problem that they're designed to solve. So, yeah.
I love it. Thanks for being here,
Dan. Of course. Thank you so much. And congratulations on such a huge milestone for your episodes. And, you know, feel free to message me if you guys want me to be back and talk more about COVID stuff or non-COVID stuff. I'm very happy to support the show. And I'm super proud of all the hard work you guys have put in to put together such a great show that's run for so long and had such success. So I tip my metaphorical cap to you, because I'm not wearing any hat by now, but still. Well done. Thank Bravo. You, bravo.
And you're invited back next week. And the week after. The week after.
Wonderful. All right. Well,
I want to get to, before we leave, I want to get to a broader conversation about vaccines instead of just COVID.
You know
what I mean? Like we used to have those conversations and now we're hyper-focused on one situation, but you know, what about shingles and what about measles and all these other things? So we need to attack the anti-vaxxers at some point beyond just COVID.
Absolutely. And again, talking about the anti-vaxxers versus the vaccine hesitant, and those people are very different. Mm-hmm. Like the people who are actively spreading misinformation and not willing to engage in meaningful discourse versus those who are concerned because they've heard some stuff, right? And you know, vaccines have been a vital tool for our progress as a society. They've stopped us from small. They eradicated smallpox. They've eradicated polio from our population. They've effectively eradicated rabies from our house pets. We've effectively nullified so many other diseases. It's a constant method throughout modern history of us to be able to live society as we take it for granted now. And this whole COVID scare has been an important kind of dress rehearsal, but an important reminder of what can happen if we do have a devastating disease that we don't have a good preventive measure for. Because scientists have been working so hard behind the scenes for so much time to make sure something like this doesn't happen. But here's the thing, we're going to fail. We failed with COVID. We fail with every new disease that's going to come out. There's going to be something way worse than COVID that's going to come out by whatever means, you know, in our lifetimes. It's going to happen. And that's not because scientists suck. It's just the environment that we live in is so complicated. It's a living, breathing, incredibly dynamic ecosystem. And as spillover keeps happening, we're going to keep threatening. So we need to continue supporting the development of vaccines and other preventative measures that we can integrate. So.
I love it. Plan ahead or fall behind.
Indeed.
All right. Well, thank you for being here. Thank you, Jeffrey, for being here. Did you have any final thoughts before we go?
No.
No. All right.
Drink plenty of.
And whenever you're free, Dan. Whenever you're free. Thank you. Thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate, you know.
I don't talk about what you do or where you've been or where you're going to go, but I do know that you're going all around the country, stopping and preventing and saving and learning, and I really appreciate you.
I'm happy to do it. And last thing, always a good health tip, drink lots of water, everyone. Stay hydrated. you can't go wrong with that. All right.
My roommate says the same thing to me because there's a message every day at 4 that says drink more water. So it's a running joke. It's a running joke around here. Are you feeling bad? Drink more water.
There you go. All right. Take care, gentlemen. Thank you so much. And congratulations again.
Thanks, Dan.
Bye-bye.
All right. And end the live stream. All right. Thank you for being here, Jeffrey.
Of course.
To those who would tear the world down, we will defeat you.
This is our moment.
This is our time. To those who seek peace and security, we support you.
Yes, we can.
And to all those who have wondered if America's beacon still burns as bright, tonight we prove once more that the true strength of our nation comes not from the might of our arms or the scale of our wealth, but from the enduring power of our ideals, democracy, liberty, opportunity, and unyielding hope.
Let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. Very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, they will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is going to hit as hard as life.
Ask not.
Yes, we can.
What your country can do for you.
I have a dream.
Ask what you can do for your country.
I, poor little children.
Yes, we can.
One day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression.
In this lifetime, you don't have to prove nothing to nobody except yourself.
But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward.
That's how winning is done.
To public access America.
Yes, we can.
Sunday live streams on YouTube.
I wanted to run out of that tunnel for my dad.
On Twitter.
Apple Podcasts. Stitcher Smart Radio app. Public.
And Spotify.
Yes, we can.
Public Access America. History in the making. Making history in the making.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.